That's impossible.
Is it? How old are you?
9. Next Aristide.
And in 9 years, you've learned everything that's both possible and impossible? Why, you're a remarkable boy, Garion.
Garion flushed.
Well, he said, somehow not quite so sure of himself, the oldest man I ever heard of is an old Weldrick over on Mildren's farm. Durnick says he's over 90, and that he's the oldest man in the district.
And it is a very big district, of course, the old man said solemnly.
How old are you?
Garion asked, not wanting to give up.
Old enough, boy, the old man said.
Well, it's still only a story,
Garion insisted.
Many good and solid men would say so, the old man told him, looking up at the stars. Good men, who will live out their lives believing only in what they can see or touch. Oh, but there's a world beyond what we can see and touch. And that world lives by its own laws. What may be impossible in this very ordinary world is very possible there. And sometimes the boundaries between the two worlds disappear. And then, who can say what is possible and impossible?
I think I'd rather live in a very ordinary world. The other one sounds too complicated.
We do not always have that choice, Garion, the storyteller told him. Don't be too surprised if that other world someday chooses you to do something that must be done. Some great and noble thing.
Me?
Garion said incredulously.
Stranger things have happened. Go to bed, boy. I think I will look at the stars for a while. The stars and I are very old friends.
The stars?
Garion asked, looking up involuntarily.
You're a very strange old man, if you don't mind my saying so.
Indeed, the storyteller agreed. Quite the strangest that you'll likely meet.
Well, I like you all the same, Garion said quickly, not wanting to give offense.
That's a comfort, boy. Now go to bed. Your Aunt Paul will be worried about you.
Later, as he slept, Garion's dreams were troubled. The dark figure of maimed Torak loomed in the shadows, and monstrous things pursued him across twisted landscapes where the possible and the impossible merged and joined, as that other world reached out to claim him. Chapter 3. Some few mornings later, when Aunt Paul had begun to scowl at his continued lurking in her kitchen, the old man made excuse of some errand to the nearby village of Upper Grault.
Good,
Aunt Paul said somewhat ungraciously.
At least my pantries will be safe while you're gone.
He bowed mockingly, his eyes twinkling. Do you need anything, Mistress Paul? Some trifling thing I might purchase for you, as long as I'm going anyway. Aunt Paul thought for a moment.
Some of my spice pots are a bit low. And there's a Tolnedrin spice merchant in Fennel Lane, just south of the town tavern. Oh, I'm sure you'll have no trouble finding the tavern.
The trip is likely to be dry, the old man admitted pleasantly. And lonely, too. 10 leagues, with no one to talk to, is a long way.
Talk to the birds,
Aunt Paul suggested bluntly.
Birds listen well enough, but their speech is repetitious. It quickly grows tiresome. Why don't I take the boy along for company?
Garion held his breath.
He is picking up enough bad habits on his own. I'd prefer his not having expert instruction.
Why, Mistress Paul, the old man objected, stealing a cruller almost absently. You do me an injustice. Besides, a change will do the boy good. Broaden his horizons, you might say.
His horizons are quite broad enough, thank you.
Garion's heart sank.
Still, at least I can count on him not to forget my spices altogether, or to become so fuddled with ale that he confuses peppercorns with cloves, or cinnamon with nutmeg. Very well, take the boy along, but mind, I don't want you taking him into any low or disreputable places.
Mistress Paul, would I frequent such places? The old man said, feigning shock.
I know you too well, old wolf. You take to vice and corruption as naturally as a duck takes to a pond. If I hear that you have taken the boy into any unsavory place, you and I will have words.
Well, then I have to make sure that you don't hear of anything like that, won't I?
Aunt Paul gave him a hard look.
I'll see which spices I need.
And I'll borrow a horse and cart from Faldor, the old man said, stealing another cruller. In a surprisingly short time, Geryon and the old man were bouncing along the rutted road to Upper Grault behind a fast-trotting horse. It was a bright summer morning, and there were a few dandelion puff clouds in the sky and deep blue shadows under the hedgerows. After a few hours, however, the sun became hot, and the jolting ride became tiresome.
"Are we almost there?"
Geryon asked for the third time.
"Not for some time yet. 10 leagues is a goodly distance."
"I was there once before," Geryon told him, trying to sound casual. "Of course, I was only a child at the time, so I don't remember too much about it. It seemed to be quite a fine place."
The old man shrugged.
"It's a village, much like any other."
He seemed a bit preoccupied. Geryon hoped to nudge the old man into a story to make the miles go faster, and began asking more questions.
"Why is it that you don't have a name, if I'm not being impolite in asking?"
"I have many names," the old man said, scratching his white beard. "Almost as many names as I have years."
"I've only got one."
"So far."
"What?"
"You only have one name so far," the old man explained. "In time, you may get another, or even several. Some people collect names as they go along through their lives. Sometimes names wear out, just like clothes."
"Aunt Paul calls you Old Wolf,"
Geryon said.
"I know. Your Aunt Paul and I have known each other for a very long time."
"Why does she call you that?"
"Who can say why a woman such as your aunt does anything?"
"May I call you Mr. Wolf?"
Names were quite important to Geryon, and the fact that the old storyteller did not seem to have one had always bothered him. That namelessness had made the old man seem somehow incomplete, unfinished. The old man looked at him soberly for a moment, and then he burst out laughing.
"Mr. Wolf, indeed! How very appropriate! I think I like that name better than any I have had in years."
"Well, may I, then? Call you Mr. Wolf, I mean."
"I think I'd like that, Geryon. I think I'd like that very much."
"Now would you please tell me a story, Mr. Wolf?"
The time and distance went by much faster then, as Mr. Wolf wove for Geryon tales of glorious adventure and dark treachery, taken from those gloomy, unending centuries of their Arendish civil wars.
"Why are they like that?" Geryon asked after a particularly grim tale.
"The Arends are very noble,"
Wolf said, lounging back in the seat of the cart with reins held negligently in one hand.
"Nobility's a trait that's not always trustworthy, since it sometimes causes men to do things for obscure reasons."
"Brunderig's an errand," Geryon said. "He sometimes seems to be, well, Not too quick a thought, if you know what I mean?
It is the effect of all that nobility. Erens spend so much time concentrating on being noble that they don't have time to think of other things.
They came over the crest of a long hill, and there, in the next valley, lay the village of Upper Gralt. To Geryon, the tiny cluster of gray stone houses with slate roofs seemed disappointingly small. Two roads, white with thick dust, intersected there, and there were a few narrow winding streets besides. The houses were square and solid, but seemed almost like toys set down in the valley below. The horizon beyond was ragged with the mountains of eastern Sindaria, and though it was summer, the tops of most of the mountains were still wrapped with snow. Their tired horse plodded down the hill toward the village, his hooves stirring up little clouds of dust with each step, and soon they were clattering along the cobblestoned streets toward the center of the village. The villagers, of course, were all too important to pay any attention to an old man and a small boy in a farm cart. The women wore gowns and high-pointed hats, and the men wore doublets and soft velvet caps. Their expressions seemed haughty, and they looked with obvious disdain at the few farmers in town, who respectfully stood aside to let them pass.
"They are very fine, aren't they?"
"They seem to think so," Wolf said, his expression faintly amused. "I think it's time that we found something to eat, don't you?" Though he had not realized it until the old man mentioned it, Geryon was suddenly ravenous.
"Where can we go? They all seem so splendid. Would any of them let strangers sit at their tables?"
Wolf laughed and shook a jingling purse at his waist. "We shouldn't have any trouble making acquaintances. There are places where one can buy food."
"Buy food?"
Geryon had never heard of such a thing before. Anyone who appeared at Faldor's gate at mealtime was invited to the table as a matter of course. The world of the villagers was obviously very different from the world of Faldor's farm.
"But I don't have any money."
"I have got enough for us both," the wolf assured him,
stopping their horse before a large, low building with a sign bearing a picture of a cluster of grapes hanging just above its door. There were words on the sign, but of course Geryon could not read them.
"What do the words say, Mr. Wolf?"
"They say that food and drink can be bought inside," the wolf told him, getting down from the cart.
"It must be a fine thing to be able to read,"
Geryon said wistfully. The old man looked at him, seemingly surprised.
"You can't read, boy?"
"I've never found anyone to teach me. Faldor reads, I think, but no one else at the farm knows how."
"Nonsense. I'll speak to your aunt about it. She's been neglecting her responsibility. She should have taught you years ago."
"Can Aunt Paul read?"
Geryon asked, stunned.
"Of course she can," the wolf said, leading the way into the tavern. "She says she finds little advantage in it. But she and I had that particular argument out many years ago."
The old man seemed quite upset by Geryon's lack of education. Geryon, however, was far too interested in the smoky interior of the tavern to pay much attention. The room was large and dark, with a low-beamed ceiling and a stone floor strewn with rushes. Though it was not cold, a fire burned in a stone pit in the center of the room, and the smoke rose errantly toward a chimney set above it on four-square stone pillars. Tallow candles guttered in clay dishes on several of the long-stained tables, and there was a reek of wine and stale beer in the air.
"What have you to eat?" the wolf demanded of a sour, unshaven man wearing a grease-spotted apron.
"We've a bit of the giant left," the man said, pointing at a spit resting to one side of the fire pit. "Roasted only day before yesterday, and meat porridge fresh yesterday morning, and bread no more than a week old."
"Very well," the wolf said, sitting down. "And I'll have a pot of your best ale, and milk for the boy."
"Milk?"
Geryon protested.
"Milk," the wolf said firmly.
"You have money?" the sour-looking man demanded. The wolf jingled his purse, and the sour man looked suddenly less sour.
"Why is that man over there sleeping?"
Garion asked, pointing at a snoring villager sitting with his head down on one of the tables.
"Drunk," the wolf said, scarcely glancing at the snoring man.
"Shouldn't someone take care of him?"
"He'd rather not be taken care of."
"Do you know him?"
"I know of him, and many others like him. I have occasionally been in that condition myself."
"Why?"
"It seemed appropriate at the time."
The roast was dry and overdone. The meat porridge was thin and watery, and the bread was stale. But Garion was too hungry to even notice. He carefully cleaned his plate as he had been taught, then sat as Mr. Wolf lingered over a second pot of ale.
"Quite splendid,"
he said, more to be saying something than out of any real conviction. All in all, he had found that Upper Gralt did not live up to his expectations.
"Adequate," the wolf shrugged. "Village taverns are much the same the world over. I have seldom seen one that I would hurry to revisit. Shall we go?"
He laid down a few coins, which the sour-looking man snatched up quickly, and led Garion back out into the afternoon sunlight.
"Let's find your aunt's spice merchant, and then we will see to a night's lodging and a stable for our horse."
They set off down the street, leaving horse and cart beside the tavern. The house of the Tolnedran spice merchant was a tall, narrow building in the next street. Two swarthy, thick-bodied men in short tunics lounged in the street at his front door, near a fierce-looking black horse wearing a curious armored saddle. The two men stared with dull-eyed disinterest at passers-by in the lane. Mr. Wolf stopped when he caught sight of them.
"Is something wrong?"
"Tulls,"
the wolf said quietly, looking hard at the two men.
"What?"
"Those two are tulls,"
the old man said.
"They usually work as porters for the Murgos."
"What are Murgos?"
"The people of Ketal Murgos,"
Wolf said shortly.
"Southern Angoraks."
"The ones we beat at the Battle of Vomimbre? Why would they be here?"
"The Murgos have taken up commerce," the wolf said, frowning. "I had not expected to see one of them in so remote a village. We may as well go in. The Tulls have seen us, and it might look strange if we turned now and went back. Stay close to me, boy, and don't say anything."
They walked past the two heavy-set men and entered the spice merchant's shop. The Tolnedran was a thin, bald-headed man wearing a brown belted gown that reached to the floor. He was nervously weighing several packets of pungent-smelling powder which lay on the counter before him.
"A good day to you,"
he said to Wolf.
"Please have patience. I'll be with you shortly."
He spoke with a slight lisp that Garion found peculiar.
"No hurry,"
Wolf said in a wheezy, cracking voice. Garion looked at him sharply, and I was astonished to see that his friend was stooped, that his head was nodding foolishly.
"See to their needs,"
the other man in the shop said shortly. He was a dark, burly man, wearing a chainmail shirt and a short sword belted to his waist. His cheekbones were high, and there were several savage-looking scars on his face. His eyes looked curiously angular, and his voice was harsh and thickly accented.
"Now, hurry,"
the wolf said in his wheezy cackle.
"My business here will take some time,"
the Murgos said coldly,
"and I prefer not to be rushed. Tell the merchant here what you need, old man."
"My thanks, then,"
the wolf cackled.
"I have a list somewhere about me."
He began to fumble foolishly in his pockets.
"My master drew it up. I do hope you can read it, friend merchant, for I cannot."
He finally found the list and presented it to the Tolnedran. The merchant glanced at the list.
"This will only take a moment," he told the Murgo.
The Murgo nodded and stood staring stonily at Wolf and Geryon. His eyes narrowed slightly, and his expression changed.
"You're seemingly appearing, boy," he said to Geryon. "What's your name?"
Until that moment in his entire life, Geryon had been an honest and truthful boy, but Wolf's manner had opened before his eyes an entire world of deception and subterfuge. Somewhere in the back of his mind he seemed to hear a warning voice, a dry, calm voice advising him that the situation was dangerous, and that he should take steps to protect himself. He hesitated only an instant before telling his first deliberate lie. He allowed his mouth to drop open, and his face to assume an expression of vacant-headed stupidity.
"Wondering, Your Honor," he mumbled.
"An Arendish name," the Murgo said, his eyes narrowing even more. "You don't look like an Arend."
Geryon gaped at him.
"Are you an Arend, Rundorig?" the Murgo pressed.
Geryon frowned as if struggling with a thought while his mind raced. The dry voice suggested several alternatives.
"My father was, but my mother's a Sendar. People say I favor her."
"You say was? Is your father dead then?"
the Murgo said quickly. His scarred face was intent. Geryon nodded foolishly.
"A tree he was cutting fell on him. It was a long time ago."
The Murgo suddenly seemed to lose interest.
"Here's a copper penny for you, boy," he said indifferently, tossing a small coin on the floor at Geryon's feet. "It has the likeness of the god Torak stamped on it. Perhaps it will bring you luck, or at least more wit."
Wolf stooped quickly and retrieved the coin, but the coin he handed to Geryon was a common Sindarian penny.
"Thank the good man, Rondorig," he wheezed.
"My thanks, Your Honor,"
Geryon said, concealing the penny tightly in his fist. The Mogo shrugged and looked away. Wolf paid the Tolnedrin merchant for the spices, and he and Geryon left the shop.
"You played a dangerous game, boy," Wolf said once they were out of earshot of the two lounging Tolls.
"You seemed not to want him to know who we were."
"I wasn't sure why, but I thought I ought to do the same,"
Geryon explained.
"Was what I did wrong?"
"You're very quick," the Wolf said approvingly.
"I think we managed to deceive the Murgo."
"Why did you change the coin?"
"Sometimes Angorak coins are not what they seem. It's better for you not to have any of them. Let's fetch our horse and cart. It's a long way back to Faldor's farm."
"I thought we were going to take lodgings for the night."
"That has changed now. Come along, boy. It is time for us to leave."
The horse was very tired, and he moved slowly up the long hill out of Upper Grout as the sun went down ahead of them.
"Why wouldn't you let me keep the Angorak penny, Mr. Wolf?"
Geryon persisted. The subject still puzzled him.
"There are many things in this world that seem to be one thing, but are in fact another," the Wolf said somewhat grimly. "I do not trust Angoraks. And I particularly do not trust Murgos. It'd be just as well, I think, if you never had anything in your possession that bears the likeness of Torak."
"But the war between the West and the Angoraks has been over for 500 years now. All men say so."
"Not all men. Now, take that robe out of the back of the cart and cover up. Your Aunt Paul would never forgive me if I let you take a chill."
"Well, I will if you think I should, but I'm not a bit cold. Not at all sleepy. I'll keep you company as we go."
"That will be a comfort, boy."
"Mr. Wolf,"
Geryon said after some time,
Did you know my mother and father?
Yes, the wolf said quietly.
My father's dead too, isn't he?
I am afraid so.
Geryon sighed deeply.
I thought so. I wish I had known them. Aunt Paul says I was only a baby when...
He couldn't bring himself to say it.
I've tried to remember my mother, but I can't.
You were very small, the wolf said.
What were they like?
The wolf scratched at his beard.
Ordinary. So ordinary you wouldn't look twice at either one of them.
Geryon was offended by that.
Aunt Paul says my mother was very beautiful.
She was.
Then how can you say she was ordinary?
She was not prominent or important. Neither was your father. Anyone who saw them thought that they were just simple village people. A young man with a young wife and their baby. That's all anyone ever saw. That's all anyone was ever supposed to see.
I don't understand.
It is very complicated.
What was my father like?
Medium size. Dark hair. A very serious young man. I liked him.
Did he love my mother?
More than anything.
And me?
Of course.
What kind of place did they live in?
It was a small place. A little village near the mountains. A long way from any main roads. They had a cottage at the end of the street. It was a small, solid little house. Your father built it himself. He was a stone cutter. I used to stop by there once in a while when I was in the neighborhood.
The old man's voice droned on, describing the village and the house and the two who lived there. Geryon listened, not even realizing it when he fell asleep. It must have been very late, almost on toward dawn. In a half-drowse, the boy felt himself lifted from the cart and carried up a flight of stairs. The old man was surprisingly strong. Aunt Paul was there. He knew that without even opening his eyes. There was a particular scent about her that he could have found in a dark room.
"Just cover him up,"
Mr. Wolf said softly to Aunt Paul. "Best not to wake him just now."
"What happened?"
Aunt Paul asked, her voice as soft as the old man's.
"There was a Murgo in town, at your spice merchant's. He asked questions, and he tried to give the boy an Angorak penny."
"In Upper Grout? Are you certain he was only a Murgo?"
"It is impossible to tell. Not even I can distinguish between Murgo and Grolem with any certainty."
"What happened to the coin?"
"I was quick enough to get it. I gave the boy a Sindarian penny instead. If our Murgo was a Grolem, we will let him follow me. I am sure that I can give him several months of entertainment."
"You'll be leaving then?"
Aunt Paul's voice seemed somehow sad.
"It is time. Right now the boy's safe enough here, and I must be abroad. There are things afoot I must see to. When Murgos begin to appear in remote places, I begin to worry. We have a great responsibility and a great care placed upon us. We must not allow ourselves to become careless."
"Will you be gone long?"
"Some years, I expect. There are many things I must look into and many people I will have to see."
"I'll miss you,"
Aunt Paul said softly.
He laughed. "Sentimentality, Paul? That's hardly in character."
"You know what I mean. I am not suited for this task you and the others have given to me. What do I know about the raising of small boys?"
"You are doing very well. Keep the boy close. And do not let his nature drive you into hysterics. Be careful. He lies like a champion."
"Geryon?"
"He lied to the Murgo so well that even I was impressed."
"Geryon?"
He has also started to ask questions about his parents. How much have you told him?
Very little. Only that they are dead.
Well, let's leave it at that for now. There's no point in telling him things he is not old enough to cope with yet. Their voices went on, but Geryon drifted off into sleep again, and he was almost sure that it was all a dream. But the next morning, when he awoke, Mr. Wolf was gone. Chapter 4 The seasons turned, as seasons will. Summer ripened into autumn, the blaze of autumn died into winter. Winter grudgingly relented to the urgency of spring, and spring bloomed into summer again. With the turning of the seasons, the years turned, and Geryon imperceptibly grew older. As he grew, the other children grew as well, all except poor Durun, who seemed doomed to be short and skinny all of his life. Rundarig sprouted like a young tree, and was soon almost as big as any man on the farm. Zabret, of course, did not grow so tall, but she developed in other ways, which the boys began to find interesting. In the early autumn, just before Geryon's 14th birthday, he came very close to ending his career. In response to some primal urge all children have, given a pond and a handy supply of logs, they had built a raft that summer. The raft was neither very large, nor was it particularly well built. It had a tendency to sink on one end if the weight aboard it was improperly distributed, and an alarming habit of coming apart at unexpected moments. Quite naturally, it was Geryon who was aboard the raft, showing off, on that fine autumn day when the raft quite suddenly decided once and for all to revert to its original state. The bindings all came undone, and the logs began to go their separate ways. Realizing his danger only at the last moment, Geryon made a desperate effort to pole for shore, but his haste only made the disintegration of his craft more rapid. In the end, he found himself standing on a single log, his arms windmilling wildly in a futile effort to retain his balance. His eyes, desperately searching for some aid, swept the marshy shore. Some distance up the slope behind his playmates, he saw the familiar figure of the man on the black horse. The man wore a dark robe, and his burning eyes watched the boy's plight. Then the spiteful log rolled under Geryon's feet, and he toppled and fell with a resounding splash. Geryon's education, unfortunately, had not included instructions in the art of swimming, and while the water was not really very deep, it was deep enough. The bottom of the pond was very unpleasant, a kind of dark, weedy ooze, inhabited by frogs, turtles, and a singularly unsavory-looking eel that slithered away snake-like when Geryon plunged like a sinking rock into the weeds. Geryon struggled, gulped water, and launched himself with his legs toward the surface again. Like a broaching whale, he rose from the depths, gasped a couple of quick, sputtering breaths, and heard the screams of his playmates. The dark figure on the slope had not moved, and for a single instant every detail of the bright afternoon was etched on Geryon's mind. He even observed that, although the rider was in the open under the full glare of the autumn sun, neither man nor horse cast any shadow. Even as his mind grappled with that impossibility, he sank once more to the murky bottom. It occurred to him as he struggled, drowning amongst the weeds, that if he could launch himself up in the vicinity of the log, he might catch hold of it, and so remain afloat. He waved off a startled-looking frog and plunged upward again. He came up, unfortunately, directly under the log. The blow on the top of his head filled his eyes with light and his ears with a roaring sound, and he sank, no longer struggling, back toward the weeds, which seemed to reach up for him. And then Durnik was there. Geryon felt himself lifted roughly by the hair toward the surface and then towed by that same convenient handle toward the shore behind Durnik's powerfully churning strokes. The smith pulled the semi-conscious boy out onto the bank, turned him over,
and stepped on him several times to force the water out of his lungs. Garion's ribs creaked.
"Enough, Durnik!"
he gasped finally. He sat up, and the blood from the splendid cut on top of his head immediately ran into his eyes. He wiped the blood clear and looked around for the dark, shadowless rider, but the figure had vanished. He tried to get up, but the world suddenly spun around him, and he fainted. When he awoke, he was in his own bed with his head wrapped in bandages. Aunt Paul stood beside his bed, her eyes blazing.
"You stupid boy! What were you doing in that pond?"
"Rafting,"
Garion said, trying to make it sound quite ordinary.
"Rafting? Rafting? Who gave you permission?"
"Well, we just..."
"You just what?"
He looked at her helplessly. And then, with a low cry, she took him in her arms and crushed him to her, almost suffocatingly. Briefly, Garion considered telling her about the strange, shadowless figure that had watched his struggles in the pond, but the dry voice in his mind that sometimes spoke to him told him that this was not the time for that. He seemed to know, somehow, that the business between him and the man on the black horse was something very private, and that the time would inevitably come when they would face each other in some kind of contest of will or deed. To speak of it now, to Aunt Paul, would involve her in the matter, and he did not want that. He was not sure exactly why, but he did know that the dark figure was an enemy. And, though that thought was a bit frightening, it was also very exciting. There was no question that Aunt Paul could deal with this stranger, but if she did, Garion knew that he would lose something very personal, and for some reason very important. And so he said nothing.
"It really wasn't anything all that dangerous, Aunt Paul,"
he said instead, rather lamely.
"I was starting to get the idea of how to swim. I'd have been all right if I hadn't hit my head on that log." "But of course you did hit your head," she pointed out. "Well, yes, but it wasn't that serious. I'd have been all right in a minute or two." "Under the circumstances, I'm not sure you had a minute or two,"
she said bluntly.
"Well,"
he faltered, and then decided to let it drop. That marked the end of Garion's freedom. Aunt Paul confined him to the scullery. He grew to know every dent and scratch on every pot in the kitchen intimately. He once estimated gloomily that he washed each one 21 times a week. In a seeming orgy of messiness, Aunt Paul suddenly could not even boil water without dirtying at least 3 or 4 pans, and Garion had to scrub every one of them. He hated it, and began to think quite seriously of running away. As autumn progressed and the weather began to deteriorate, the other children were also more or less confined to the compound as well, and it wasn't so bad. Runderig, of course, was seldom with them anymore, since his man's size had made him, even more than Garion, subject to more and more frequent labor. When he could, Garion slipped away to be with Zumrat and Dorun, but they no longer found much entertainment in leaping into the hay or in the endless games of tag in the stables and barns. They had reached an age and size where adults rather quickly noticed such idleness and found tasks to occupy them. Most often, they would sit in some out-of-the-way place and simply talk, which is to say that Garion and Zubret would sit and listen to the endless flow of Darun's chatter. That small, quick boy, as unable to be quiet as he was to sit still, could seemingly talk for hours about a half-dozen raindrops, and his words tumbled out breathlessly as he fidgeted.
"What's that mark on your hand, Garion?"
Zubret asked one rainy day, interrupting Darun's bubbling voice. Garion looked at the perfectly round white patch on the palm of his right hand.
"Oh, I've noticed that too,"
Darun said, quickly changing subjects in mid-sentence.
"But Garion grew up in the kitchen, didn't you, Garion? Probably a place where he burned himself when he was little, you know, reached out before anyone could stop him, put his hand on something hot. I'll bet his Aunt Polly really got angry about that, because she can get angrier faster than anybody else I've ever seen, and she can really..."
"It's always been there," Garion said, tracing the mark on his palm with his left forefinger. He had never really looked closely at it before. It covered the entire palm of his hand, and had in certain light a faint silvery sheen.
"Oh, maybe it's a birthmark,"
Zubrette suggested.
"I'll bet that's it," Darun said quickly. "I saw a man once that had a big purple one on the side of his face, one of those wagoneers that comes by to pick up the turnip crop in the fall. Anyway, the mark was all over the side of his face, and I thought it was a big bruise at first, and thought that he must have been in an awful fight. Those wagoneers fight all the time. But then I saw that it wasn't really a bruise, but, like Zubrette just said, it was a birthmark. I wonder what causes things like that."
That evening, after he had gotten ready for bed, he asked his aunt about it.
"What's this mark, Aunt Paul?"
he asked, holding his hand up, palm out. She looked up from where she was brushing her long, dark hair.
"It's nothing to worry about."
"Well, I wasn't worried about it. I just wondered what it was. Zubrette and Darun think it's a birthmark. Is that what it is?"
"Something like that."
"Did either of my parents have the same kind of mark?"
"Your father did. It's been in the family for a long time."
A sudden strange thought occurred to Geryon. Without knowing why, he reached out with a hand and touched the white lock at his aunt's brow.
"Is it like that white place in your hair?"
He felt a sudden tingle in his hand, and it seemed somehow that a window opened in his mind. At first there was only the sense of uncountable years moving by like a vast sea of ponderously rolling clouds, and then, sharper than any knife, a feeling of endlessly repeated loss, of sorrow. Then, more recent, there was his own face, and behind it more faces, old, young, regal, or quite ordinary. And behind them all, no longer foolish as it sometimes seemed, the face of Mr. Wolfe. But more than anything, there was a knowledge of an unearthly, inhuman power, the certainty of an unconquerable will. Aunt Paul moved her head away almost absently.
"Don't do that, Geryon,"
she said, and the window in his mind shut.
"What was it?"
he asked, burning with curiosity and wanting to open the window again.
"A simple trick. Show me how." "Not yet, my Geryon," she said, taking his face between her hands. "Not yet. You are not ready yet. Now, go to bed."
"You'll be here?"
he asked, a little frightened now.
"I will always be here."
She tucked him in, and then she went back to brushing her long, thick hair, humming a strange song as she did, in a deep, melodious voice. And to that sound, he fell asleep. After that, not even Geryon himself saw the mark on his own palm very often. There suddenly seemed to be all kinds of dirty jobs for him to do, which kept not only his hands, but the rest of him as well, very dirty. The most important holiday in Cinderia, and indeed in the rest of the kingdoms of the West, was Eristide. It commemorated the day, eons before, when the seven gods joined hands to create the world with a single word. The festival of Eristide took place in midwinter, and because there was little to do on a farm like Faldor's at that season, it had, by custom, become a splendid two-week celebration, with feasts and gifts and decorations in the dining hall, and little pageants honoring the gods. These last, of course, were a reflection of Faldor's piety. Faldor, though he was a good, simple man, had no illusions about how widely his sentiments were shared by others on the farm. He thought, however, that some outward show of devotional activity was in keeping with the season, and because he was such a good master, the people on his farm chose to humor him. It was also at this season, unfortunately, that Faldor's married daughter, Anhelda, and her husband, Adelbrig, made their customary annual visit to remain on speaking terms with her father. Anhelda had no intention of endangering her inheritance rights by seeming inattention. Her visits, however, were a trial to Faldor, who looked upon his daughter's somewhat overdressed and supercilious husband, a minor functionary in a commercial house in the capital city of Sindar, with scarcely concealed contempt. Their arrival, however, marked the beginning of the Eristide Festival at Faldor's farm,
So, while no one cared for them personally, their appearance was always greeted with a certain enthusiasm. The weather that year had been particularly foul, even for Sundarya. The rains had settled in early, and were soon followed by a period of soggy snow, not the crisp, bright powder which came later in the winter, but a damp slush, always half-melting. For Geryon, whose duties in the kitchen now prevented him from joining with his former playmates in their traditional pre-holiday orgy of anticipatory excitement, the approaching holiday seemed somehow flat and stale. He yearned back to the good old days, and often sighed with regret, moping about the kitchen like a sandy-haired cloud of doom. Even the traditional decorations in the dining hall, where Eristide festivities always took place, seemed decidedly tacky to him that year. The fir boughs festooning the ceiling beams were somehow not as green, and the polished apples carefully tied to the boughs were smaller and not as red. He sighed some more and reveled in his sullen moping. Aunt Paul, however, was not impressed, and her attitude was firmly unsympathetic. She routinely checked his brow with her hands for signs of fever, then dosed him with the foulest-tasting tonic she could concoct. Geryon was careful after that to mope in private, and to sigh less audibly. That dry, secret part of his mind informed him, matter-of-factly, that he was being ridiculous, but Geryon chose not to listen. The voice in his mind was much older and wiser than he, but it seemed determined to take all of the fun out of life. On the morning of Eristide, Emurgo and 5 thulls appeared with a wagon outside of the gate and asked to see Faldor. Geryon, who had long since learned that no one pays attention to a boy, and that many interesting things may be learned by placing himself in a position to casually overhear conversations, busied himself with some small, unimportant chore near the gate. The Murgo, his face scarred much like the face of the one in Upper Grault, sat importantly on the wagon seat, his chain-mail shirt clinking each time he moved. He wore a black hooded robe, and his sword was much in evidence. His eyes moved constantly, taking in everything. The thulls, in muddy felt boots and heavy cloaks, lounged disinterestedly against the wagon, seemingly indifferent to the raw wind whipping across the snowy fields. Faldor, in his finest doublet, it was, after all, Eristide, came across the yard, closely followed by Anhelda and Eidelbrig. "Good morrow, friend," Faldor said to the Murgo. "Joyous Eristide to you." The Murgo grunted. "I take it you're the farmer Faldor," he asked in his heavily accented voice. "I am," Faldor replied. "I understand. You have a goodly number of hams on hand. Well cured." "The pigs did well this year," Faldor answered modestly. "I will buy them," the Murgo announced, jingling his purse. Faldor bowed. "First thing tomorrow morning." The Murgo stared. "This is a pious household. We don't offend the gods by breaking the sanctity of Eristide," Faldor explained.
"Father," Anhelda snapped, "don't be so foolish. This noble merchant has come a long way to do business."
"Not on Eristide," Faldor said stubbornly, his long face firm.
"In the city of Sendar," Albrig said in his rather high-pitched nasal voice, "we do not let such sentimentality interfere with business."
"This is not the city of Sendar. This is Faldur's farm, and on Faldur's farm we do no work and conduct no business on Eristide."
"Father," Anhelda protested, "the noble merchant has gold. Gold, father, gold."
"I won't hear any more of it," Faldor announced. He turned to the Murgo. "You and your servants are welcome to join us in our celebration, friend. We can provide quarters for you and the promise of the finest dinner in all of Sundaria, and the opportunity to honor the gods on this special day. No man is made poorer by attending to his religious obligations.
We do not observe this holiday in Catril Murgos, the scar-faced man said coldly. As the noble lady says, I have come a long way to do business. Even have not much time to tarry. I am sure there are other farmers in the district with the merchandise that I require.
Father!
Anhelda wailed.
I know my neighbors, Felder said quietly. Your luck today will be small, I fear. The observance of this day is a firm tradition in this area.
The Murgo thought for a moment.
It may be as you say, he said finally. I will accept your invitation, provided that we can do business as early as possible tomorrow.
Faldor bowed. I'll place myself at your service at first light of the morrow, if you so desire.
Done, then,
the Murgo said, climbing down from his wagon. That afternoon the feast was laid in the dining hall. The kitchen helpers and a half-dozen others who had been pressed into service for the special day scurried from kitchen to hall, bearing smoking roasts, steaming hams, and sizzling geese, all under the lash of Aunt Paul's tongue. Geryon observed sourly as he struggled with an enormous baron of beef that Faldor's prohibition of work on Eristide stopped at the kitchen door. In time, all was ready. The tables were loaded with the fires in the fireplaces burning brightly. Dozens of candles filled the hall with a golden light, and torches flared in their rings on the stone pillars. Faldor's people, all in their best clothes, filed into the hall, their mouths watering in anticipation. When all were seated, Faldor rose from his bench at the head of the center table.
"Dear friends," he said, lifting his tankard, "I dedicate this feast to the gods."
"The gods," the people responded in unison, rising respectfully. Faldor drank briefly, and they all followed suit.
"Hear me, O gods," he prayed. "Most humbly, we thank you for the bounty of this fair world which you made on this day, and we dedicate ourselves to your service for yet another year."
He looked for a moment, as if he were going to say more, but then sat down instead. Faldor always labored for many hours over special prayers for occasions such as this, but the agony of speaking in public invariably erased the words so carefully prepared from his mind. His prayers, therefore, were always very sincere and very short.
"Eat, dear friends. Don't let the food grow cold."
And so they ate. Anhelda and Eidelbrig, who joined them all at this meal only at Faldor's insistence, directed their conversational efforts to the Mugo, since he was the only one in the room who was worthy of their attention.
"I have long thought of visiting Tol Murgos,"
Eidelbrig stated rather pompously.
"Oh, don't you agree, friend merchant, that greater contact between East and West is the way to overcome those mutual suspicions which have so marred our relationships in the past?"
"We Murgos prefer to keep to ourselves," the scar-faced man said shortly.
"But you are here, friend,"
Albrecht pointed out.
"Doesn't that suggest that greater contact might prove beneficial?"
"I'm here as a duty," the Murgo said. "I don't visit here out of preference."
He looked around the room.
"Are these, then, all of your people?"
he asked Faldor.
"Every soul is here," Faldor told him. "I was led to believe there was an old man here, with white hair and beard." "Not here, friend. I myself am the eldest here, and as you can see, my hair is far from white." "One of my countrymen met such a one some years ago. He was accompanied by an Arendish boy, Rondorik, I believe his name was."
Geryon, seated at the next table, kept his face to his plate, and listened so hard that he thought his ears must be growing.
"Well, we have a boy named Rondorig here,"
The tall lad at the end of the far table over there.
No,
the Murgo said, looking hard at Rendrig.
That is not the boy who was described to me.
It's not an uncommon name among the Erns, Thaldor said. Quite probably your friend met a pair from another farm.
That must be it,
the Murgo said, seeming to dismiss the affair.
This ham is excellent, he said, pointing at his plate with the point of the dagger with which he ate. Are the ones in your smokehouse of similar quality?
Oh, no, friend merchant. You won't so easily trick me into talking business on this day. The Murgo smiled briefly, the expression appearing strange on his scarred face.
One can always try. I would, however, compliment your cook.
A compliment for you, Mistress Paul, Thaldor said, raising his voice slightly.
Our friend from Cathal Murgos finds your cooking much to his liking.
I thank him for his compliment,
Aunt Paul said somewhat coldly. The Murgo looked at her, and his eyes widened slightly, as if in recognition.
A noble meal, great lady,
he said, bowing slightly in her direction.
Your kitchen is a place of magic.
No,
she said, her face suddenly very haughty.
Not magic. Cooking is an art which anyone with patience may learn. Magic is quite something else.
Ah, but magic is also an art, great lady.
There are many who think so. But true magic comes from within, and is not the result of nimble fingers which trick the eye.
The Murgo stared at her, his face hard, and she returned his gaze with steely eyes. To Geryon, sitting nearby, it seemed as if something had passed between them that had nothing to do with the words that they spoke. A kind of challenge seemed to hang in the air. And then the Murgo looked away, almost as if he feared to take up the challenge. When the meal was over, it was time for the rather simple pageant, which traditionally marked Irristide. Seven of the older farmhands who had slipped away earlier appeared in the doorway, wearing the long hooded robes and carefully carved and painted masks which represented the faces of the gods. The costumes were old, and showed the wrinkles which were the result of having been packed away in Faldor's attic for the past year. With a slow step, the robed and masked figures paced into the hall and lined up at the foot of the table where Faldor sat. Then each, in turn, spoke a short piece which identified the god he represented.
"I am Aldor," Kralto's voice came from behind the first mask. "The god who dwells alone, and I command this world to be."
"I am Belar,"
came another familiar voice from behind the second mask. "Bear god of the Alons, and I command this world to be." And so it went down the line. Caradhan, Hissa, Nidra, Mara. And then finally the last figure, which, unlike the others, was robed in black, and whose mask was made of steel instead of painted wood.
I am Torak.
Dernik's voice came hollowly from behind the mask.
Dragon god of the Ingraks. Thy command this world to be.
A movement caught Geryon's eye, and he looked quickly. The Murgo had covered his face with his hands in a strange, almost ceremonial gesture. Beyond him, at the far table, the five Tulls were ashen-faced and trembling. The seven figures at the foot of Faldor's table joined their hands.
We are the gods, they said in unison, and we command this world to be.
Hearken unto the words of the gods, Faldor declaimed.
Welcome are the gods in the house of Faldor.
The blessings of the gods be upon the house of Faldor, the seven responded, and upon all this company. And then they turned, and as slowly as they had come, they paced from the hall. Then came the gifts. There was much excitement at this, for the gifts were all from Faldor, and the good farmer struggled long each year to provide the most suitable gift for each of his people.
New tunics and hose and gowns and shoes were much in evidence, but Geryon this year was nearly overwhelmed when he opened a smallish cloth-wrapped bundle and found a neat, well-sheathed dagger.
"He's nearly a man," Faldor explained to Aunt Paul. "And a man has always got a need of a good knife."
Geryon, of course, immediately tested the edge of his gift and quite promptly managed to cut his finger.
"It was inevitable, I suppose,"
Aunt Paul said. But whether she was speaking of the cut or of the gift itself, or the fact of Geryon's growing up, was not entirely clear.
The Murgo bought his hams the next morning, and he and the five thulls departed.
A few days later, Anhelda and Eidelbrig packed up and left on their return journey to the city of Sundar, and Faldor's farm returned to Norbul. The winter plodded on, the snows came and went, and spring returned, as it always does. The only thing which made that spring any different from any other was the arrival of Brill, the new hand. One of the younger farmers had married and rented a small nearby croft, and had left, laden down with practical gifts and good advice from Faldor, to begin his life as a married man. Brill was hired to replace him. Geryon found Brill to be a definitely unattractive addition to the farm. The man's tunic and hose were patched and stained, his black hair and scraggly beard were unkempt, and one of his eyes looked off in a different direction from its fellow. He was a sour, solitary man, and he was none too clean. He seemed to carry with him an acrid reek of stale sweat that hung in his vicinity like a miasma. After a few attempts at conversation, Geryon gave up and avoided him. The boy, however, had other things to occupy his mind during that spring and summer. Though he had until then considered her to be more an inconvenience than a genuine playmate, quite suddenly he began to notice Zubret. He had always known that she was pretty, but until that particular season that fact had been unimportant, and he had much preferred the company of Rundurig and Dorun. Now matters had changed. He noticed that the two other boys had also begun to pay more attention to her as well, and for the first time he began to feel the stirrings of jealousy. Zubret, of course, flirted outrageously with all three of them, and positively glowed when they glared at each other in her presence. Rundurig's duties in the fields kept him away most of the time, but Dorun was a serious worry to Geryon. He became quite nervous, and frequently found excuses to go about the compound to make certain that Dorun and Zubret were not alone together. His own campaign was charmingly simple. He resorted to bribery. Zubret, like all little girls, was fond of sweets, and Geryon had access to the entire kitchen. In a short period of time, they had worked out an arrangement. Geryon would steal sweets from the kitchen for his sunny-haired playmate, and in return she would let him kiss her. Things might perhaps have gone further if Aunt Paul had not caught them in the midst of such an exchange one bright summer afternoon in the seclusion of the hay barn.
"That is quite enough of that,"
she announced firmly from the doorway. Geryon jumped guiltily away from Zubret.
"I've got something in my eye," Zubret lied quickly. "Geryon was trying to get it out for me."
Geryon stood blushing furiously.
"Really?"
Aunt Paul said.
"How interesting. Come with me, Geryon."
He started.
"Now, Geryon?"
And that was the end of that. Geryon's time thereafter was totally occupied in the kitchen, and Aunt Paul's eyes seemed to be on him every moment. He mooned about a great deal and worried desperately about Dorun, who now appeared hatefully smug, but Aunt Paul remained watchful, and Geryon remained in the kitchen. Chapter 5. In mid-autumn that year, when the leaves had turned and the wind had showered them down from the trees like red and gold snow, when evenings were chill, and the smoke from the chimneys at Faldor's farm rose straight and blue toward the first cold stars in a purpling sky, Wolf returned. He came up the road one gusty afternoon under a lowering autumn sky, with the new fallen leaves tumbling about him, and his great dark cloak whipping in the wind. Geryon, who had been dumping kitchen slop to the pigs, saw his approach and ran to meet him. The old man seemed travel-stained and tired, and his face under his gray hood was grim. His usual demeanor of happy-go-lucky cheerfulness had been replaced by a somber mood that Geryon had never seen in him before.
"Geryon," the wolf said by way of greeting, "you have grown, I see."
"Well, it has been 5 years."
"Has it been that long?"
Geryon nodded, falling into step beside his friend.
"Is everyone well?"
"Oh, yes. Everything's the same here. Except that Braldo got married and moved away. And the old brown cow died last summer."
"I remember the cow," the wolf said.
And then he said,
"I must speak with your Aunt Paul."
"Oh, she's not in a very good mood today," Geryon warned. "It might be better if you rested in one of the barns. I can sneak some food and drink to you in a bit."
"We will have to chance her mood. What I have to say to her cannot wait."
They entered the gate and crossed the courtyard to the kitchen door. Aunt Paul was waiting.
"You again?"
she said tartly, her hands on her hips.
"My kitchen still has not recovered from your last visit."
"Mistress Paul," the wolf said, bowing.
And then he did a strange thing. His fingers traced an intricate little design in the air in front of his chest. Geryon was quite sure that he was not intended to see those gestures. Aunt Paul's eyes widened slightly, then narrowed, and her face became grim.
"How do you..."
she started, and then caught herself. "Geryon, I need some carrots. There are still some in the ground at the far end of the kitchen garden. Take a spade and a pail and fetch me some."
"But..."
he protested. And then, warned by her expression, he left, quickly. He got a spade and pail from a nearby shed and then loitered near the kitchen door. Eavesdropping, of course, was not a nice habit, and was considered the worst sort of bad manners in Sindaria. But Geryon had long ago concluded that whenever he was sent away, the conversation was bound to be very interesting, and would probably concern him rather intimately. He had wrestled briefly with his conscience about it, but since he really saw no harm in the practice, as long as he did not repeat anything he heard, conscience had lost to curiosity. Geryon's ears were very sharp, but it took him a moment or two to separate the two familiar voices from the other sounds in the kitchen.
"He won't leave you a trail,"
Aunt Paul was saying.
"He does not have to. The thing itself will make its trail known to me. I can follow it as easily as a fox can scent out the track of a rabbit."
"Where will he take it?"
"Who can say? His mind's closed to me. My guess is that he will go north to Bokdor. That is the shortest route to Garog Nadrak. He will know that I'll be after him, and he will want to cross into the lands of the Angaraks as soon as possible. His theft will not be complete so long as he stays in the west."
"And when did it happen?"
4 weeks ago."
"He could already be in the Angarak kingdoms."
"It's not likely. The distances are great. But if he is, I will have to follow him. I'll need your help."
"But how can I leave here? I have to watch over the boy."